Never go to the second location. Always trust your gut.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Here on Residue, we tell you the truth behind your favorite movies, and today we are talking about a made-for-TV movie called She Made Them Do It, starring Jenna Dewan. Before we begin, you know that you can follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, TikTok at Residue, a true crime podcast, and Facebook Residue, a true crime podcast. And do not forget to hit that follow button so you can join us back here every Tuesday. And as always, the greatest thing that you could possibly do is leave a positive review. And my Lord above, thank you all so much for leaving these amazing reviews this week. I love you all. Resi crew forever. Before we begin, do not forget that listener discretion is always advised. She Made Them Do It is a 2012 Lifetime movie based on the controversial criminal case of Sarah Jo Pender, a woman convicted of orchestrating a double murder who later escaped from prison and became one of America's most wanted fugitives. This film was directed by Grant Harvey and stars Jenna Dewan as Sarah Pender. The film's title reflects the prosecution's argument that Sarah Pender manipulated others into committing crimes for her, and one of the movie's central ideas is ambiguity. It repeatedly asks whether she was a calculating manipulator or a wrongly convicted woman, and rather than giving a definitive answer, the film presents conflicting impressions and leaves viewers to draw their own conclusions. And this mirrors the real-life controversy surrounding Sarah Pender's case, which has long generated debate among prosecutors, journalists, and supporters. So, as usual, this Lifetime movie received very mixed reviews. Some viewers praised Jenna Dewan's performance and the movie's ability to keep audiences uncertain about Sarah's role in this crime, and others criticized it as a typical Lifetime true crime movie that simplifies a very complicated real-life case, because this case is extremely complicated. Okay, let's read some reviews. These reviews come from RottenTomatoes.com, and this review gives the movie 1 star out of 5, a bad Lifetime movie about the real-life story of Sarah Pender wrongly accused of murder and serving time in prison for it. It's bad enough that this film got made, but even more injustice that the makers of the film didn't even bother to get their facts right and instead have filmed the lies and not the truth. The truth is, Sarah got railroaded by a justice system that does not want to admit that it is corrupt. That's the movie that should have gotten made. This next reviewer gives the movie 3 out of 5 stars, writing, "Very interesting story. Jenna Dewan was very convincing in her role. She was so likable that it always kept me wondering if she really did commit the crimes she was convicted of." Now, there is a docuseries on Hulu titled Girl on the Run, The Hunt for America's Most Wanted Woman, which was one of my main sources for today's episode, and this was just released this year in 2026. This docuseries contains a lot of interviews with Sarah Pender, her ex-boyfriend Richard Hall. They have some interviews with the prosecutor, the detectives that were hot on her trail. So I really suggest, highly suggest, that you guys watch this documentary. I'm really interested in your thoughts and opinions on Sarah, and I would love to hear what you guys think about her guilt or innocence. When you finish listening to this episode, just leave me some comments on Spotify or DM me your thoughts on Sarah Pender. Sarah Sarah Jo Pender was born May 29, 1979, and Sarah had a sister, Jennifer. Her parents say that Sarah was a joyful child. She was kind, considerate, very intelligent, highly intelligent. She was very close to her family. She was accepted at Purdue for biophysics, biochemistry, trigonometry, and calculus. Sarah's father always taught her that education is the most important thing, so when she did arrive at Purdue, she felt ashamed, and she felt really awful at the fact that she didn't spend any time studying. She failed all of her classes, and she decided she didn't want to go back to college. This college experience made her realize that she felt no self-worth from her intelligence, from being a highly intelligent person. This didn't give her happiness. She states in the docuseries Girl on the Run that what gave her happiness was making other people happy. So when Sarah was 6 years old, her parents divorced, and her mother, Bonnie, left the family. She just left the kids with Sarah's father, and she said she had to go off on her own to better herself. And Sarah had a lot of issues with this. She felt this incredible sense of abandonment, and she was afraid of being alone. She always wanted to be loved. She wanted someone to protect her because her mother left at such a young age. So after Sarah drops out of Purdue, she worked as a secretary at a company called Carl E. Most & Sons. She was working in the office at a construction company, basically, and she meets this guy named Richard Hull. Now, when she meets Richard, he tells her that he's a bouncer. He works at a bar. And he also lied about owning a carpet cleaning business. Now, at the time that Sarah met him, he had a criminal history that included 2 felony convictions for auto theft and residential entry and 6 misdemeanors. When Sarah met Rick, she says that he was manly, he was protective, and this was something that she really needed at that time. It felt good to her to be protected. So they start dating, and she would call him her protector. Richard, who we're going to just start calling him Rick, because that's what most people refer to him as, Rick says that if he could go back to the first time that he ever met Sarah, that he would just leave. I mean, the one thing that Rick really liked about his relationship with Sarah right off the bat was the fact that she had a typical 9-to-5 job, so he could do his drug dealing without anyone being suspicious as to how they're paying their bills. Sarah goes to her 9-to-5 Monday through Friday, and Rick sells drugs. At this point, Sarah is 21 years old. Rick is 20. They're together for a couple of weeks. Rick comes to Sarah and tells her, listen, my friends need a place to stay just for a little bit. Their names are Andrew Cataldi and Trisha Nordman. Andrew's 24, Trisha's 25. They just need to move in with us for a little bit. So the four of them find a house together and they all move in. Now, Sarah believed her and Rick would end up getting married, having kids, moving to the suburbs, but their life turned out to be very different. Rick's 2 friends, Andrew, who goes by Drew, and his girlfriend, Trisha, they were both fugitives from a Nevada correctional facility where Trisha was serving time for forgery and Drew was serving time for possession with intent to distribute methamphetamines. Neighbors said that tensions were growing between these two couples living in this house together, that they heard frequent fights, and there were police reports that Rick and Andrew were selling drugs from the home. Now, what happened on the night of October 24th, 2000, the night of the murders? There are very differing reports from Sarah and from Rick. So I am going to read you Sarah's explanation of what happened the night of October 24th, 2000. She claims that her and Rick were out with her father and her stepmom all night. And when they came home, Rick and Drew started arguing over money that Rick's sister owed to Drew for drugs. Rick looked at Sarah and he told her, you're going to probably want to leave this house right now. But Sarah said, I don't have anywhere to go. Where am I supposed to go? So she says that she just walked outside, walked around the neighborhood alone. And when she came home, the house felt, quote, quiet and wrong. And Sarah says she heard a noise, but she didn't know what the noise was. So she's calling out for Rick, and she couldn't see anyone. She didn't see Rick, Drew, or Trisha. But she looks down and she sees blood on the floor. She walks into the living room and she finds Rick bent over and putting Trisha's body into a blanket. Sarah says at that point, she was deathly afraid of what Rick was going to do, and she didn't know what to do. So she just said, "Ricky," and he looked at her, and then they just stared at each other for what she felt like was an eternity. And she says that in that moment, she thought she was about to be the next one to die. But they just stared, and then she froze, and then she said, "What do you want me to do to help you?" So Rick told her to go get a blanket. So she did, and then Rick dragged Trisha's body across the floor to take her out of the house. He put her body into the back of a pickup truck, and Sarah sees that Drew's body is already in the back of that truck. She said that she felt helpless. She felt scared. She knew that if she did anything or said anything, Rick was going to hurt her too. So Rick tells her to get into the truck, and she did. And at that moment, she thought, this is not real. This will all go away. They drove a few blocks to a dumpster behind a building, and they placed Trisha and Drew's body inside of that dumpster. But Rick says that this is not what happened that night. Rick says that Drew was his friend, Drew was his brother, he would have never murdered Drew or Trisha. He claims that he was the one that walked into the home, and he saw Sarah acting a mess. She was rocking back and forth, and there were two dead bodies laying on the floor in that house. And Rick looks at the camera in the documentary Girl on the Run and says, "Who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe Rick, a 6'4", 350-pound man with a goatee drug dealer? Or are you going to believe some girl that looks like Sarah and is seemingly an adult working her way through college? Who are you going to believe?" That is the question that Rick asks. The fact is, Trisha and Drew were murdered and their bodies were dumped into a dumpster by Sarah and Rick, really only a few blocks from the house they shared with a couple. Later that day, around 6 o'clock p.m., a man who worked for the sanitation department, his name was Steven Stoltz. He was an employee of the Teamsters local union. He discovered the bodies of Trisha and Drew in this dumpster, and he phoned police. Drew had been shot in the chest, and Trisha was shot in the chest and the head with a shotgun. Descriptions of the victims and pictures of their tattoos were shown on TV newscast that night, and police get a call from a neighbor of the victims, and the neighbor tells them that these victims lived with Sarah Pender and Richard Hull. Police arrive at the address of Sarah and Rick, 906 South Meikle Street, and they discover, among other things, that there was a ton of blood at the scene. They used DNA analysis, and it was determined that the blood at the scene belonged to Trisha Nordman. They also start talking to neighbors. They're canvassing the neighborhood, and they talk to this neighbor named Jana Frederick. Jana tells police that Rick borrowed this plug adapter because he had to use a shampoo machine to clean his carpet. They also find out that Rick borrowed the pickup truck that was used to transport the bodies from a friend. So they go to that friend and they test the pickup truck for DNA samples. They get back blood samples that are consistent with Drew and Trish, and they arrest Sarah Pender and Richard Hull. Richard Hull is questioned October 27th, and he is asked about this murder, and he says, "No, I didn't do it. I don't know anything about it." But then the police present him with all of this evidence that they have already gathered. But then detectives hit Rick with one more evidence punch, and they tell him, "Hey, we know that Sarah went to Walmart the morning of the murders and bought a shotgun." Rick says that he didn't think that Sarah was going to use this gun to kill Drew and Trish, that he had no idea that she wanted to get the gun or why she got the gun. Rick claims that he did not want this gun. He didn't need this gun because he's a drug dealer. And if he wanted a gun really badly, he could have just gotten one. He would have had no problem getting himself a gun. But Sarah claims she only bought the gun the morning of the murders because Rick begged her to, that he asked if she could sign for the gun, if she could pay for the gun. And she said, okay, because she was very scared That's her story. They drove to Walmart together. He looked around. He picked out the gun he wanted. He placed it on the counter. Sarah signed for it. And that's her story. She had absolutely no idea why he wanted the gun, what he was going to do with it. She didn't ask him. She just did it because she was scared. When Sarah is interrogated, detectives say that she cried a lot through her interview, that she was very scared, and that she kept saying, "I'm not a liar, I don't know how to lie." And I do have to say that she does say that in the docuseries also. She says, "I'm not a liar, I don't know how to lie." They also say that she was a little bit flirtatious in their interrogations and their interviews, and that she seemed to be the type of person that would talk her way out of stuff, that she was just used to being able to talk her way out of stuff. This is the words of the detectives. They said she would kind of twirl her hair, flip her hair, and that was very flirtatious to them. 20 months after the murders of Drew Cataldi and Tricia Nordman, Sarah and Rick are still in jail awaiting trial. And at this point, Sarah believes that she's going to be let out soon, that this is all a mistake. She's, you know, claiming she didn't help. She had nothing to do with this. Yes, she did go and buy the gun, but she had no idea that it was going to be used for this purpose. And when the murders did take place, she was out on a walk. She thought she was in the clear, ready to go home. July 2002, Sarah's trial begins, and she is up against prosecutor Larry Sells, who does not like Sarah at all. He says that she just so happens to be the female Charles Manson. He felt so good about the evidence in the Sarah Pender case, he knew that he was going to be able to put her behind bars. Larry Sells argues to the jury that Sarah had the opportunity to leave, but she didn't. He also brings in a witness named Floyd Pennington. Sarah and Floyd had this pen pal type of relationship. They called it a, quote, steamy relationship through letter. Sarah said that Floyd was charming and he used proper grammar. So these two are writing back and forth. They're kind of digging each other, and they decide to come up with this plan to fake an illness, and they would both end up in the infirmary. And while they're there, they could actually meet in person, talk in person. Floyd told Sarah that he wanted a real relationship, and she also wanted a real relationship. But he told her, "I need you to tell me the truth about the murders." So during Sarah's trial, Floyd gets up on the stand and he testifies that Sarah told him that day in the infirmary that she wanted to get rid of those roommates for money. So she bought the shotgun and convinced Rick to commit these murders. Sarah says that as she sat there in the courtroom listening to Floyd tell this story, she couldn't understand why he was doing it. She said inside she was screaming, "Why are you lying? I never told him that." Now, along with Floyd Pennington's testimony, prosecutor Larry Sells also had something else up his sleeve. He had a letter that would prove that Sarah Pender was guilty. Rick Hall said that he had a letter that was allegedly sent to him by Sarah Pender in May of 2001. And in this letter, Sarah took responsibility for the murder. She wrote, "I wish I could go back and change the events of that night. Drew was so mean that night. I just snapped. I didn't mean to kill them. It must have been the acid. When you said you would try to take the blame, I knew that you loved me deeply. At first, I thought you would tell, but you stuck to your promise." And this letter ended with, "Destroy this." After this evidence was presented, Sarah's defense attorney claims this is ridiculous. Sarah is no clever mastermind. She did not organize this crime. And he says that the murder was not a cleverly planned criminal act. It was an act in the moment. And her defense attorney argued that Rick Hall shot Drew Cataldi and Tricia Nordman because they were about to cut him out of a big drug deal. That's the reason for the murder. On August 22, 2002, Sarah Pender was found guilty and she was sentenced to 110 years in prison. Now, Rick Hall pleaded guilty to avoid trial. So his defense was that he was influenced by Sarah Pender. I mean, come on, she's the female Charles Manson. Of course, he wouldn't have done this on his own. Had to be the work of some witchy, magical woman who put a spell on him, right? Richard Hall received two 45-year sentences. Sarah was sent to the Rockville Correctional Facility in Indiana. It is a maximum security facility with razor-wired fences, armed guards, and towers. There are 1,200 inmates, all women. And on August 4th, 2008, Sarah Jo Pender escaped this maximum security prison. Sarah Pender says being sentenced to over 100 years for two murders that she did not commit, sitting in her prison cell all day, having nothing to do but think, she thought, you know what? I bet I can get out of here. Sarah met a girl in jail named Jamie, and they had a relationship, but now Jamie was out, and she was free. Sarah fell in love with Jamie because she was a badass and she liked to take risks. So Jamie's out and free, and with the help of Jamie Long, her former cellmate, and prison guard Scott Spittler, Sarah was able to devise an escape plan. So this prison guard, Scott Spittler, he was married. He had kids, but he was also having a lot of sex with Sarah Pender behind bars. Planning this escape took months. Sarah knew she was going to need money, so she befriended Scott Spittler because she identified him as someone she could manipulate. And Sarah would get money. She would send it to Jamie on the outside to hold for her. And she asked Scott for help. And Scott said, yeah, I'll help. If you give me $15,000, I'll drive you to the parking lot. And Sarah said yes, that she would give Scott $15K for a drive to the parking lot. And in that parking lot, Jamie Long would be waiting for Sarah. Scott also said, I'll help you if you have sex with me. And so Sarah said, I did what I had to do. Scott drove Sarah in a van and dropped her off where Jamie would pick her up. And Scott even told Sarah that he loved her and that he wanted to talk to her after she was out. And she said, don't worry, I love you too, and I'll text you later. But Sarah never called and Sarah never texted. And detectives start thinking, did Sarah use Scott? Did she take her magical powers and use that man? Like, that man surely would have never had sex with an inmate because he's married and he has children. He's an upstanding citizen. Of course, it was all Sarah that just like hypnotized him into having sex with her in prison. I mean, this is the way that everyone seems to think in this case. They find out that Sarah escaped pretty quickly because they do about 3 head counts a day in this prison. And after viewing some video surveillance tapes, they conclude that Scott Spittler was Sarah's accomplice. So he was very quickly arrested on August 5th, 2008. He was charged with assisting a criminal, official misconduct, sexual misconduct, and trafficking with an inmate. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison. And then they realize, okay, her ex-girlfriend, Jamie Long, she's out. So let's start looking into her. Now, Jamie had already dropped Sarah off at a safe house, and then she left her there to go get her clothes, hair dye, a cell phone, and all of that money she was supposed to get her. But Scott tells detectives, I know that she's working with Jamie Long, her ex-girlfriend, her ex-cellmate. Now, Jamie's not dumb. She knows that police are probably on her trail. So she's trying to stay real undercover with this, and she's not going back to the safe house she dropped Sarah at, because she knows the police might be following her. So she comes up with this plan with another ex-cellmate that they know named Peggy Darlington. Now Peggy's out and she decides, yes, she wants to help Sarah. So what can she do? The plan is this. Peggy is going to drive to the safe house, pick up Sarah. Sarah gets in her back trunk. They drive to McDonald's, where Jamie will be waiting inside of one of the stalls in the women's bathroom. She'll have all of the money that Sarah has sent her over these past few months. I mean, because this plan is not going to work if Sarah doesn't have money. So Peggy goes into the McDonald's. She walks into the bathroom and she says, Jamie? And she sees 2 feet underneath a stall. Jamie goes, yeah. And then she just slides an envelope under the door. Peggy takes it, leaves the restaurant, gets back in her car, and drives away. Peggy now drives Sarah to a Motel 8, gets her a hotel room. They go in the room. Sarah opens the envelope, and inside is only $350. She sent Jamie over $3,500. Jamie tells them, "I'm sorry, I couldn't give you all the money because I feel like the police are on my tail. I'm afraid of getting caught and they take all of your money, so I didn't bring all of it." And Jamie was right, because that very night, detectives show up at her front door. Now, Jamie lives with this man that she is caring for. She's his caregiver. He's very old and he needs her help. Like, he cannot live without her. So Jamie's not talking. And detectives, specifically U.S. Marshal Ryan Harmon, tells her, "Listen, you're in a lot of trouble here. If we take you in right now, you're not going to be here to help care for this man." So they're talking to the man, too, and trying to get him to talk to Jamie and tell her, "Listen, you have to tell these detectives what they want to know, because I need you to be here for me. Forget about your friend. She did something bad." So Jamie says, "Okay." And she takes the detectives upstairs to her bedroom, opens a closet, gets a shoebox out, and shows them all of this money. And she gives them all of Sarah's money, and then they ask her to call Sarah. So Sarah answered when Jamie called, but Sarah could tell that Jamie sounded really off. And these two start lying to each other, and Sarah is pretending that she is staying at a farmhouse. So she's telling her, "Yeah, I really like this farmhouse. It was really nice being here." And detectives realize that Sarah is smart, and this is not going to be an easy woman to capture. Now Sarah knows something's up. She changes out her cell phones, throws away the cell phone she was using to talk to Jamie. She cuts her hair off. She dyes it darker. And she realizes that she might have made some bad choices, but she's got to continue going on because she refuses to go back to prison. Sarah has been on the run for 48 hours, and detectives go to Richard Hull, Rick, her ex-boyfriend. They go to the prison, they speak to him, and they go, "Maybe you might know where she could be hiding." And at this point, Richard says that he had many mixed emotions about Sarah's escape. Like, he said he was happy that she got out of prison, but that he was also hurting inside because he ruined his life because of Sarah. For Sarah. And he starts to realize, you know what, I'm probably going to end up dying in this prison. But after he complains about his life and his decisions, he starts talking about the fact that Sarah knew a girl named Thea. And Thea was a stripper. He tells them that Thea will work different clubs, different nights just to make extra money. And it is possible that Sarah could be hanging out with her to make extra money now that she doesn't have the money she saved up for. And you know what? He was right, because Sarah was hanging out with Thea, and Thea had a very good suggestion for Sarah. Now, Thea met this man outside of her club who was this rich, older businessman. He really wanted a threesome. They meet up at the hotel. Sarah says that when she met Tom, he was pretty well-built. He was dressed nice. He smelled nice. And she told him his name was Brandy. This guy, Tom, says that he lived in strip joints, that sex was his drug and it took over. After the threesome, Tom told them that they could just stay in this hotel room because he already paid for it. So they take advantage of this and they just stay in this hotel room. Little do they know that detectives are hot on their trail, because they know that Thea works different strip clubs. So they're actually going to like every single strip club in this area and just looking for Sarah, thinking maybe Sarah's stripping, doing amateur nights to gain more money. Rick tells them about certain tattoos that Sarah has. So they're out there looking at these women, looking for tattoos on all of these strippers, and they cannot find Sarah. It's because she's in this hotel room, like locked up with this man who is now becoming her, as she said, sugar daddy. I mean, honestly, this thing happened so quick. We're only on day 3 of Sarah's escape, and she's already hooked on this guy, and this guy's hooked on her. Sarah said he literally said to her, "It was like eating a Lay's potato chip. You can't just have one." He's referring to having sex with Sarah. He is so addicted to her. He keeps coming back for more. So one night, they're in bed in this hotel room watching TV, and a news story comes on about Sarah Bender. And Tom says to her, "Oh my God, like, I don't know what to do. This is so out of my realm of life. I don't know what to do. Should I go tell the cops?" And she's like, "No." She tells him the entire story, her version of the story, which I told you earlier. Mind you, this guy's all like, this isn't in my realm of life, acting like he's some kind of saint. This dude is married with children, and he was complaining to the detectives, like, my wife, she travels way too much, so I just started going to strip clubs. He even says in the interrogation, in the interview, you know, I was really good at playing golf for a while, and I got my score into the 70s, fantastic score, you know, but I got bored of that, so I just started having a lot of sex with different women. So that's my hobby now. So Tom and Sarah are shacking up in this motel. Tom is her sugar daddy. He's also starting to have feelings for her. And Tom wanted to go out. He wanted to show Sarah off, but she knew she couldn't be caught. She can't be seen. She changes her appearance again. She said that one of the things that made her valuable to Tom is that she would do whatever he wanted. So in turn, he would give Sarah money. He would keep her safe in this motel room. But Sarah is starting to become very paranoid. She knows that she needs to keep moving. She needs to get out of Indianapolis. And she asked Tom to help her. This is day 7 of Sarah on the run. And the way that she describes this relationship with Tom, you'd think this was going on for months. It was only day 7 that she'd been on the run, but only a few days that she knew Tom. So Tom's going to help Sarah escape Indianapolis. Before she leaves, Sarah puts a track phone in the mail, a brand new phone that is untraceable, and sends it to her friend Peggy. Sarah was really nervous about leaving all of her friends behind, so she wanted to be able to get in touch with Peggy, but she didn't know that Peggy was already talking to U.S. Marshal Ryan Harmon. She calls him immediately, tells him about the phone, and detectives tell Peggy, you have to call Sarah on this phone and you have to act normal. But Peggy is like a ball of nerves. Peggy is so nervous, even in this documentary, when she is in the interview sessions, she is so shaky and scared to be talking. And detectives are trying to locate the tower where Sarah is at. So Peggy's keeping her on the phone as long as she can. And Sarah says to Peggy, I can't turn myself in. This is what I chose to do. And if I go back to prison, I'm going to kill myself. She said, actually, on this phone call that detectives were listening to, she tells Peggy, I would almost rather that detectives do catch me and then just shoot me because they'd be doing me a favor. Now, while they're speaking to each other, detectives get a hit on a tower outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. They immediately call the Cincinnati, Ohio police. Everyone's on the scene. They are canvassing the area of where Sarah made this phone call, but they can't find her. And Ryan Harmon says, a good hunter will never give up. U.S. Marshal Ryan Harmon, his entire life became Sarah Pender, became the capture of Sarah Pender. It was all he could think about. He even ends up in the end losing his family, losing his wife, his children, his marriage ended because he put so much time and effort into trying to catch Sarah Pender. And now we are on day 40 of Sarah on the run. This is when the America's Most Wanted episode airs. And during that episode, John Walsh says she manipulates people. She never stopped working her craft. Everyone around her was putty in her hands. This episode airs, and Tom and Sarah are in a hotel room watching America's Most Wanted. Larry Sells, the prosecutor in Sarah's case, tells everyone that Sarah is a woman to be feared, that she, quote, has a Charles Manson-type quality. And Sarah says to this, because she's watching this and thinking, these people don't even know me at all. Now all of a sudden she's been branded Charles Manson. She says it is very common for a man to blame a woman for their actions. Now, this show generated a ton of leads. Tips come in from Minnesota, California, Texas. And of course, every single tip has to be looked into. And after this episode airs, all of Sarah's friends disappear. She has absolutely no contacts anymore, except for Tom. She dyes her hair again. She buys colored contacts, changed her eye color to hazel. She got glasses. Tom arranged for her to stay with a friend of his niece's. So Sarah got on a bus and she was on her way to her new destination where she was going to hide out. She said on that bus ride, she just pretended that everything was fine. And after Sarah got off that bus in Chicago to start her new life hiding out, she acted like everything was fine. She went to work. She found someone that needed an assessor, and that's what she used to do at her old construction contracting job. She enjoyed walking to work every single morning. She said that she even met a man on the corner one day walking his dogs, and she stopped, had a conversation with him, and she enjoyed every second of being free, like little things we take for granted. She said she enjoyed hearing her footsteps on the pavement every morning, getting a coffee before work, talking to a random stranger. Meanwhile, she is on the 15 most wanted fugitive list. She is the only woman on that list, and they were offering a $25,000 reward for any information on Sarah Pender. Sarah is settled in on the north side of Chicago, where she calls herself Ashley Thompson. And on December 22nd, 2008, 2 hours after America's Most Wanted put on a rerun of the original episode, Sarah's neighbor identifies her and calls in a tip. At 11 p.m., while Sarah was just in her apartment enjoying the night, she hears a knock on the door and they yell, "Maintenance!" She gets really nervous. She knows this can't be a maintenance guy at 11 p.m. She looks out the peephole and she sees four men, some of them wearing bulletproof vests, and she thinks, "I could grab my go bag and run out the back," because there was a back door. But instead, she opened the door and she said to them, "Just let me get my shoes." Four men escorted her out in handcuffs. When Sarah was returned to prison, she was put into solitary confinement. And Sarah says that it's just steel and concrete. You get a toilet, a sink, and a mat, and all you have is your mind. And it ravages you, and it eats you up, and it's a cycle, and you can't get your mind to shut up. She was told that she would not be released from solitary after a year of being in there. And they told her it was indefinite. There was no time limit. They didn't know how long she was going to be in there. She talks about how her mind started unraveling and she couldn't make sense of numbers anymore. She sat on the floor playing solitaire by herself and she couldn't understand the numbers. Now, this was a woman who was accepted into Purdue for trigonometry. She was highly intelligent. She had no idea what was happening to her, but she knew something bad was happening. It felt like her mind was ripping apart and a part of her was floating away. And she didn't have thoughts anymore. She says all she had was white noise. Sarah spent 4 years in solitary confinement, and she said she was afraid that she was losing her mind. It is around this time that prosecutor Larry Sells, the guy who dubbed Sarah Pender the female Charles Manson, he calls Sarah's mom, Bonnie, and he says to her on the phone, "Bonnie, I've done 72 murder cases, and only one was a mistake, and that was your daughter, Sarah." Sarah did not receive a fair trial. And why did he change his mind? Well, an author named Stephen Miller wrote a book about Sarah's case, and he asked Larry Sells to come with him and look at some homicide files. And they go through all of these files. And in one of the files, Larry Sells sees a file titled Floyd Pennington. And inside of that file, there were two sheets of paper. They had a list of violent criminals, gangs. This was a snitch list, a list of people that Floyd Pennington would turn in to get a better deal on his sentence. Floyd Pennington, one of the reasons that Sarah Pender went to jail, was on a snitch list. Larry says that he never received this file, and it made him realize, oh my God, there has to be more to this case. Larry feels he messed up. He wants to make this right. In 2013, he calls a reporter for the Indianapolis Star named Vic Reichart, and he tells him all of the problems that he has with Sarah's case, Floyd Pennington, and then the letter. If you remember, the letter that Richard Hall gave to his defense attorney, who then gave it to the prosecution, the letter where Sarah confessed to the murders. Well, the circumstances on how that letter was delivered to prosecutors was sus. It was handed over by Rick to his attorney. And now Rick had a cellmate named Steve Logan. And this cellmate knew how to, you know, copy people's handwriting. So Rick asked him to do him a favor. He gave them some of the letters that Sarah had written him, and he asked them to look over them and rewrite a letter in Sarah's handwriting, and that was the letter that was used at trial. Now, Rick claims that he didn't write it. He doesn't know who did, but he knows he didn't write it, so not his problem. Prosecutor Larry Sells has both of these new pieces of evidence, and he realizes, oh my God, I've got to make this right. So he starts working with Sarah's new defense attorney to present this new evidence. And at this time, Sarah is now in her fifth year of being in solitary confinement when she hears that she might be let out into the transitional unit, but on very close observation. And then she also learns that Larry Sells is trying to get her out of prison. 17 years after her capture, not after the murders, but after her capture, Martin Tankliff, a man who was wrongfully imprisoned and exonerated, was now representing Sarah. Martin Tankliff was wrongfully convicted of murdering his parents when he was only 17 years old. And after serving almost 18 years of imprisonment, his conviction was vacated and he was released from prison in 2007 and he became an attorney. Now, they say there is no possibility of just exonerating Sarah. So they are asking for mercy because solitary confinement for 5 years is absolutely insane for the crime she committed. So they want to modify her sentence and they have a modification hearing. Sarah speaks and she says, I want to go home and keep working to make myself and the world a better place. They ask that Sarah is eligible for immediate release, but the judge wants time to contemplate his decision. And on January 5th, 2026, Sarah's petition for early release was denied. She will remain in prison until at least 2054, when she will be 75 years old. And Richard Hall, serving his 90-year sentence, he will have his first parole hearing in 2044. Tom, the married businessman with children who wanted a threesome, who said that strippers were his new drug or sex was his drug, he told detectives in an interview that he was basically addicted to Sarah, that she, quote, entrances you. He said, I don't know if in prison she learned hypnosis. So it's Sarah's fault that you kept seeing her, that you gave her money. It's not your fault. You're the one that asked for a threesome, but it must be Sarah's fault because she learned hypnosis in prison. Also, Sarah is the female Charles Manson. And okay, I'm not saying that I believe Sarah is completely innocent in this, but what I'm saying is, what do they say about Richard Hall? What do they say about Scott Spittler, the guy that helped her escape prison? What do they say about Tom, the businessman who was married with children? I don't hear anything about them being bad people and them doing bad things and making bad choices. It's that Sarah made them do what they did. Whether or not Sarah Pender is this evil genius, manipulator, she's Charles Manson, or she's a victim of a flawed justice system, of Richard Hall, all of that has been debated online for years. But the fact of the matter is that two people still lost their lives, and they are not talked about. And let me tell you, it is pretty difficult to find information on Andrew and Trisha. The two victims in this case never get discussed. It's one of those cases where the victims get lost in the sensationalism, in the Charles Manson, the female Charles Manson of it all. When Sarah had her modification hearing, her mother Bonnie got up on the stand. She cried and she said, I've lost 25 birthdays, 25 Christmases. I pray that I can have the rest of my life with my daughter. And all I could think was 24-year-old Andrew Cataldi and 25-year-old Trisha Nordman's families have said the same thing for decades. Thank you so much for being here with me today. Do not forget to hit that follow button so you can meet me back here next Tuesday. And until then, stay safe and stay paranoid. Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne.